to live righteously. It's time for another episode of the Cultural Hall. Thank you so much for joining us. Those who are maybe first-timers to the Cultural Hall, it's a community where we talk about all things to do with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. That is a mouthful, and maybe this conversation will be a mouthful as well. I'm joined by Wendy Ulrich, who is a PhD, an MBA, a psychologist, and founder of 16 Stones Center for Growth. She has consulted a variety of business organizations, has taught at BYU, and is a former president of the Association of Mormon Counselors and Psychologists. She's also author of the book, Live Up to Our Privileges, and we'll talk a bunch about that and get to know her. Welcome, Wendy.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Richie.
You know, I just have to say, it has been a long time coming. I think the first initial email that I got that said that you would be willing to come in was over a year ago, and so I apologize for the delay, but grateful that we were able to connect this morning.
I am too.
So I want to get to know you a little bit, and then I want to make sure that we spend plenty of time talking about Live Up to Your Privileges. For people who don't know what that book's about, give them a little tease for what we may be talking about later.
Well, the subtitle on the book is Women, Power, and Priesthood, if that helps.
Yes.
So we are trying to figure out what are the privileges that we hold as members of the church. I think some of this is as relevant to men as it is to women, but I had to limit it somewhere, so that's the direction that I go with.
So we'll make sure that we get into some of that later, but I think it's great to lay the foundation so that people know, well, who is this Wendy Ulrich, PhD, MBA that we're talking to? So start wherever you'd like. Where are you, a lifelong member of the church? Where were you born and raised?
Born and raised in California, lifelong member of the church, inactive father, I guess I would say, pretty active mother, and went to BYU, raised our family actually in Michigan, and spent over 20 years back east in Michigan and Quebec area, and moved to Utah about 15 years ago. I think under the influence of the Spirit, sort of kicking and screaming because I wasn't sure I was going to like it here at all. But we've been very happy and having a good experience here.
So we're going to pick up some of those pieces that you dangled out there. Dad being inactive and mom being active, was that ever sort of a contention within the home?
There was plenty of contention in my home, things, actually, but that was certainly one of them. My father did decide when my mother was pregnant with me, actually, to go to the temple for the first time and never went back. So one of my interesting experiences growing up was recognizing both my mother's love for the temple and my father's dislike for it, and trying to navigate that tension in my own life. What is the temple about? What is church about? And many, many discussions with both of them about all of those things.
Well, and as a kid, I mean, you want to make parents happy, right? I think that's
sort
of an innate thing. And when you have such polar opposites as far as that, like, how do you navigate that?
Very tenuously and with lots of tears. In my case, being kind of a sensitive kid, I grew to have an extreme dislike for conflict. But it's an interesting process because I think it does sort of hone my sensitivity in some ways to the many kinds of issues that we struggle with in the church. And I had an interesting experience in my early years as having a Sunday school teacher who was extremely knowledgeable in the church, sometimes was asked by well-known professors at BYU to come teach their classes, but she ended up completely going off the deep end while I was on my mission in France and took many of my best friends with her into what I would guess we would call apostasy. She just really went off the deep end, and many of them were excommunicated from the church for apostasy, basically, and for sexual involvements that they thought were authorized by the Spirit that were kind of crazy and goofy. So had a lot of interesting experiences growing up with both the beauties of the gospel and the goodness that it brings into people's lives and some of the challenges that we face in trying to understand what the Spirit is in our lives and where it directs us, and find our own way while still making our lives work and not just become destructive in other people's lives.
Yeah, so I feel a little bit of a kindred spirit, just to let you know. So, you know, Dad has served in many leadership callings, you know, the stake presidencies and bishops and all that stuff. Parents are divorced. Mom, at the time of divorce, said, "Yeah, I'm out. This church, I'm good. We're done."
Yeah.
And then being able to navigate that into adulthood, both parents still around, both parents remarried and have found relationships that suited them and sort of their life's choices better. But it is a, as one would maybe define, a tightrope walking, where it's like, do we talk about this? Are we able to talk about this? Because faith is such an important part of me that leads and guides and directs me. And how can I connect that to someone who said, yeah, your faith tradition, I want nothing to do with it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have people in my own family today with whom I'm navigating some of those things as we try to find respectful ways to love each other and to support each other and to support the faith journey that each of us is on in a way that may be different from our own.
Hmm. And, do you have any advice?
I think the Lord's advice is pretty clear. We're to love each other.
Yeah.
If I were to summarize everything I'm reading about what we're to do to prepare for the last days, to be part of the last days, if that's the time frame that we seem to indeed be in, it's that we are to learn charity and humility and the ability to just love people where they are and listen to people where they are and put aside a lot of the judgments and leave those to the Lord. They're not our business. So that's my personal strategy anyway.
And then to kind of move on in some of the things that you talked about, to know that someone who you respected, who was respected by others within the church, who essentially led those people away under the guise of, you know, I'm sure being faithful or...
Oh. Well, under the guise of, you know, Christ is telling me what to do and the Spirit is guiding everything I say and I've had my calling and election made sure and seen the Savior and here we go. You know, now I'm to be the wife of 12 men and the you know, the mother of the child of Christ, and I mean just way off the deep end. And so and yet I would say in my early years, much of the foundation of my knowledge of the gospel was based in my experiences in that Sunday school class. So this is kind of an interesting topic to have gotten off on early. This is not something I talk about very often, but very aware that it's a tricky thing to find our own path to what it feels like to respond to the promptings of the Spirit, to find our own way, and that is a learning experience. We will all make mistakes in that process, but there are checks and balances in place to help us stay on track. I have certainly made more than my share, you know, of mistakes in that process, but we are trying to learn, and I'm grateful to know that learning is part of the deal. It's not just you're given the gift of the Holy Ghost and as long as your intentions are good, you're good to go. It is something we have to learn by both success and failure over a long period of time. And that is where that spiritual power seems to come from, is from exercising and learning that gift.
You know, it's been fascinating for me as I have matured to recognize people's fallibility.
Absolutely.
Both in leaders of the church and just in leaders in my community and in some ways, leaders within my own household to just be like, hey, you know what? Not perfect. That is something that I think if you would have talked to 30 years ago me, it would have been like, no, that's not how that works. Those individuals are perfect. And to be able to then reconcile that imperfection and still be able to hold to, you know, to faith and to belief, it can sometimes be a pretty rough journey.
Absolutely, it can. There's an old joke that in Catholicism, the belief is that the Pope is infallible, but nobody believes it. And in Mormonism, we don't believe that the prophet is infallible. We say that he is human, and nobody believes that.
Right.
It is an interesting psychological journey for everyone to put down some of the idealism that we grow up with and our absolute conviction that if it comes out of the prophet's mouth, it has to be 100% correct, and to realize, no, of course these people are human. We're all human, and we're doing the best we can, but if we have the idea that our safety lies wholly in just doing exactly what other people tell us to do. The prophets themselves will tell us, no, don't go there. Mm-hmm. My Brigham Young said his biggest concern was that the people would listen to everything he said.
Yeah.
And not get their own personal witness. So there is a check and balance system here that we are required to grow ourselves in those spiritual privileges. But we are also accountable to the teachings that we are being given, and we can sustain our leaders, even though we know that they're doing the best they can, just like we're doing the best we can. But we're not going to all be perfect, and that is a growing up process to get comfortable with that. And I can remember, you know, fairly early in that process for me, just hearing from some people I know who were very high up in the church, their disgruntlement with some of the things that they were hearing, and just being devastated, thinking these were the people that were, you know, that had the red ticket to perfection. These are, you know, the ones that I assumed I just had to count on. But I, of course, have realized sometimes the people who are the most idealistic about that fall the hardest, because we feel so disgruntled and so dismayed when we find out we disagree with somebody, or they've gotten angry at somebody, or, you know, they haven't gotten it all right, or their kids aren't perfect. And it's really a tricky process to sort of navigate that maturation and that growth. I love a statement by C.S. Lewis, and I'll butcher it because I don't have it right in front of me, but he basically says, you know, science progresses because science faces hard things, and in the faith we have to do the same. But the doctrines we least like and are least comfortable with are often the very ones we most need, precisely because they push us to grow. And I think that's true in a lot of things. Sometimes the people we least like and who are saying the things we are least comfortable with are actually giving us messages we need to struggle with, we need to face, we need to not just assume we've got all the answers, but we need to not just assume, you know, that they've got it all perfect either. We're all allowed to change our minds.
It's an interesting like flex into growth, right? When you think of today, modern day, that we experience a lot of people who we call maybe, you know, faith challenges or faith crises, mm-hmm. or, you know, those things, who are navigating, especially that early church history, you know, the prophet Joseph Smith, and being able to reconcile that this is an imperfect person, but that had always been taught almost to be perfect. Although I think that if you logically speak to members of the church, we would have been like, no, of course he wasn't perfect. But we sort of, you know, set up the restoration as a perfection, and Joseph Smith in and his role within the restoration as a perfection. And so to be able to not come to grips necessarily, but to be able to, I guess, reconcile, to reuse my word, how that all comes to play. I think that is where and why we see a lot of people not able to do it. Just kind of. Yeah.
No, it is a maturing process. And a lot of times the things that we struggle with the most have more to do with our personal history than with church history. They are often more about our personal struggles and our personal psychology, I think, than we realize they are. I notice at least that the kinds of things that bug people vary quite a bit. You know, some of us are really incensed by one thing and pretty comfortable and not really upset about another. And then the next person, it's the reverse, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it's because of personal issues that we've had in our lives, trauma that we've experienced, or betrayals, or problems that we've had with you know, this, that, or the other, where those have sensitized us, and we have to find our own healing through those things if we're going to get to a little more mature place, which is a process and a difficult one.
I want to pick up some other pieces, and then maybe we get to current day. You went from Southern California to BYU. Was that just the pilgrimage that everybody does?
Oh, yeah. Didn't even occur to me to go anyplace else. You know, this was quite a long time ago, and I was going to go to BYU and get married, and that was going to be, you know, my life. And I got to BYU and didn't get married, and then had to face a really challenging period of time where I was like, well, now what am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
I'd chosen a kind of useless major that I couldn't get a job in, and yet I really didn't want to go on a mission. My mother and grandmother actually were both sister missionaries, so I was a prospective third generation sister missionary. But
which for that time I would assume is fairly uncommon.
Yeah, well, my mother was, you know, sister missionary during World War II, and my grandmother was the first sister missionary in her mission back in the early 20s.
Where did she serve?
She served under Melvin J. Ballard, actually, in the Northwest States Mission up
Interesting.
In Oregon and Seattle areas. And so I had that legacy, and I, you know, sort of thought maybe I'd go on a mission at some point in time, but when it really came down to doing it, I was like, ah! But I thought I was being completely open about what did the Lord want me to do, because, you know, I thought I was being honest with myself until I had a pretty dramatic dream one night that let me know that the Lord had given me many indications that he wanted me to go on a mission, and he was a little uncomfortable with the fact that I continued to deny them, and I woke up just going, you know. But that was a whole other story, but
yeah.
Interesting process. I was especially not wanting to go on a mission because I thought, I'm going to be postponing marriage for a year and a half, and that's the only thing I know to do.
Yeah. Were there prospects, or was it just the idea?
I mean, I had some prospects, but not really anybody I felt like was the right person for me. And so I headed off on my mission and ended up meeting my husband in the first city that I was assigned to. So did get married shortly thereafter, but then began to face other challenges. You know, I began having children right away, was thrilled with that, and then found out that's really hard work.
Yeah,
Which I wasn't quite expecting either. But so anyway, began to look at some more schooling in my life as I watched other people around me making that balance work, and as I really sought, you know, very carefully what I felt I wanted and what I felt the Lord wanted for me. So
Let's take a break real quick. When we come back, I want to talk about that expectation of motherhood and then the reality of motherhood. Mm. We'll do that coming back in the second block of the Cultural Hall.
Hey, this is Dan, the Laptop Man from PC Laptops. I know we're going through a lot right now. Many states are quarantining people to their homes so that they have to work remotely. One of the things that's really important is to have a computer that's functioning correctly. One with a good webcam, one that's fast so you can be productive, one that has a good quality screen because you're going to be on this all day remotely. Computer supply has been strained because manufacturing has almost stopped. At PC Laptops, we've secured a limited quantity of laptop and desktop computers that are backed with a lifetime service guarantee. They're available for you right now in limited quantity. The great thing about PC Laptops is this. Once you buy your new computer, if you have any problems or questions, we're here to take care of you. Also, to make it really easy right now, we've arranged with some banks to offer 12-month special financing. Get into PC Laptops right now, because at PC Laptops, we're here for you and we're in this together. PCLaptops.com.
Here in the second block of the Cultural Hall, hope you're enjoying this episode. I just love all that we've been able to do recently here in the Cultural Hall, and hope you're enjoying it as well. If you have not yet gone to wherever you got this episode and left us a review, please do so. It matters. I know that you may think it doesn't matter, or these are just words, or it's some sort of vanity number of the amount of reviews that they're getting for the Cultural Hall. That's not the case. It's some sort of sciencey, algorithmically thing that helps us to get recognized. Take a minute. If you like this episode or you've liked other episodes in the past, you can be specific as to what you like about the Cultural Hall, or you can just say, hey, you know what? It's great. Most people will do that on their Apple podcast app, but wherever you're getting this episode, take a second, leave us a review, and let us know what you feel. Thank you very much. So, Wendy, here in the second block, I hear this story more and more, and maybe it's just because I'm keenly sensitive to it, but we have this expectation, sort of maybe cultural driven through the church, but where we're like, yes, the greatest thing you will ever do is being a parent. I feel it certainly as a man, but I think women are more sensitive to it, that it's like being a parent of children, it's the most divine role, it's the greatest thing. And there are a lot of people who get into it, and if they're being honest, they would say it is the greatest thing, but they also find it to be the literal hardest thing that they have ever done in the existence of ever.
Yeah, I would be in probably that category. And And I started out thinking, you know, getting married and having children was sort of like winning the lottery or mm-hmm. winning a beauty contest. You know, you get to go forward then and wave and, you know, smile and everything will be lovely and your life will be a wonderful thing. And I think I especially kind of assumed and hoped that that would be the case because, of course, I was going to do a better job than my parents did. And then I got into it and thought, I'm not doing half as good as my parents.
How did they do this?
This is really hard. And it was important for me to realize this is not like winning the lottery. This is like getting a job.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't expect to get a job and then just sort of get the paycheck and go to work every day and smile and wave and everybody loves you, and that's the end of the process. You expect it to be difficult. You expect it to be tiring. You expect it to be challenging. And parenting is certainly that way in spades. It's the hardest job I've ever done, and I've done some hard jobs. But some of it is just hard because it's boring. Some of it's hard because you don't have a clue what to do. Some mm-hmm. of it's hard because you're exhausted. Some of it's hard for all kinds of reasons, including that you love these children more than life itself, and you want the best for them, and you know your own weaknesses are not necessarily up to the job. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think parenting is a very difficult thing, but I am so, so grateful and, you know, so hopeful that my own children would have that privilege, because I think it is a privilege, and I'm so grateful that I had that privilege. My children are the most important people in my life, and my grandchildren are sort of a close second. So.
I know a lot of people will say that the grandchildren are blessings that the hard times from
fun.
The children give you.
Yeah, they're much more fun because you don't have to go through all the hardest parts with them, but there's so much learning, and I think that's the issue for me. I just felt like there was just so much to learn. And once I realized I'm not just trying to teach my children, I have so much to learn from them and with them from this process of, well, you know, I'm a psychologist by training, so I'm a pretty introspective person, I guess. But there was so much to be gained in my personal growth and development from trying to figure out and see where I kept running up against roadblocks and where my current skills were inadequate and where I just didn't get these kids that I assumed would, you know, be just like me. And so, of course, I would understand them. And they were sometimes like me and sometimes completely different. And I had to learn a whole new set of realities about how the world works and how people are. So
you mentioned, I mean, and I queued this up in the introduction as well. You got a lot of letters after your name. I'm assuming that after you went to BYU and were like, meh, school, whatever, the marriage thing didn't happen right away, but then the mission, and then you met your husband, that you had to go back and find yourself back in school, but then also with kids in the house.
That's right. And so my husband was getting, he decided to go for a doctorate at UCLA. And I thought, well, the honest story is my husband is a complete workaholic and uh-huh. kind of a crazy person, but also extremely, extremely supportive. Uh-huh. And I figured if my kids were ever going to know their father, I'd better be doing something with my life that required him to be home with them. And he was absolutely, you know, willing to do that and very supportive if I wanted to do anything. So while he was at UCLA, I got an MBA at UCLA and went to the evening program. The story that's kind of funny there is they have an evening program for people who are fully employed that you can go at a slower pace. And I thought that would really help so that I didn't have to go during the day. I could go at more flexible hours. I could take a little longer time. So that's what I applied to. And they turned me down and said, I had said, you know, they said, what's your career? I said, motherhood. I'm a mother. That's my career.
Yeah.
And they said, well, that's not what this program is for. We don't consider motherhood a career.
Oh.
And I called them back and we talked about that a little bit. And I said, well, you know, let me just make sure that I've got your quote on that, because I think the LA Times will be very interested to hear that UCLA doesn't consider motherhood a career. So why don't you think that over? And you know, I'll be happy to call the newspaper tomorrow and give them that information. And they called me back within, you know, within 24 hours and said, welcome to the MBA program. So I did an MBA, but as I began to look further, decided really I was looking at organizational behavior and organizational psychology in that MBA program, and then decided, you know, what I'm really more interested in is the personal level.
Yeah.
So when we moved to the University of Michigan for my husband's career, I also applied to a PhD program there in psychology. So
just to point out, if people didn't catch some of the things that you said, well, your husband was getting a PhD, you were getting an MBA. How many kids were at home at this time?
Two.
Okay.
Had my second one in the first year of my MBA program.
Oh my gosh.
Had the third one actually in the middle of finals week of my first year in my PhD program. Which was a little, you know, a little challenging.
Yeah, there are easier ways to do this.
There are easier ways to do this. And people often ask me, how in the world did you do this? And I say, I have no idea. You know, you just muddle through.
Yeah.
You do the best you can. But I had a real, you know, a real strong, not so much about the MBA. The MBA was kind of a, as they say, sort of a calculated way to get my husband to have a good relationship with his children, which mm-hmm. he does. But once I got into that PhD level and was looking at that, I had some pretty strong spiritual experiences mm. that pulled me in that direction. Psychology had not been my background at all. I'd had one class in it, and so it was a bit of an interesting process to get into a PhD program at a pretty big university in psychology. But, you know, the Lord was with me in it. I don't know how else to say it. Got some real, once I decided what I wanted to do and had a firm grasp on, you know, this really is what I want. It was like this push behind me, just, okay, go. And in 3 weeks' time, you know, take the GRE in psychology, study for it, apply to these. We didn't even know where we were going.
Yeah.
I just had a slight impression at an earlier time that we were going to Ann Arbor. In a completely disconnected context. And so I thought, well, that's all I got. So, you know, it seems like I'm supposed to be doing this. I guess I'll apply to schools around Ann Arbor. But we didn't know that's where we were going at all. It was just all I had to work with. And it turned out that that's where we ended up. So it was an interesting process.
Well, and what a testimony builder to be able to be instructed by God. Right? Led.
Very important that I was instructed by God, because when I am pregnant, which I was, I'd been struggling with infertility, actually, but got pregnant as soon as I started my PhD program.
Oh my gosh.
I started a month pregnant. So I am, like, emotionally impaired when I'm pregnant. I'm just hormonally challenged and depressed and miserable and awful, and was told early in that program by one of my supervisors, you know, what do you want to do with psychology? And I said, I want to be a psychologist. And she said, you should be, you know, if you want to stay in this field, you better be doing research in a back room someplace. You have no business, you know, working with clients. You need therapy yourself.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it was confirming my worst fears. But I just had such, you know, enough clarity spiritually that this is what I needed to do, that I just stuck with it and put my head down and kept going. And fortunately, once my 13-pound child was born,
oh my gosh,
in the middle of that finals week, my hormones quickly readjusted and I became a somewhat normal person again, although she was probably right about me needing therapy.
So. Oh my gosh. Wow.
Crazy story.
It's interesting. You talk about that experience about being able to go to Michigan and be able to have your PhD. And it's a topic that we've had of discussion here in the Cultural Hall quite a bit, maybe not so much as of late, but the idea that the church outside of Utah is certainly different than the church inside of Utah. And early on, you said you weren't quite sure that you wanted to come back to Utah after your time living, as some people insultingly call it, in the mission field.
Right.
Talk about those concerns, and are they realities?
There are some realities. There are some differences, absolutely. Ann Arbor's a pretty, you know, I had interesting relationships with colleagues, with members of the church there, with the group of friends that I had there. I still remember as a ward and stake relief society president, both, that the biggest, you know, comment I often got from people was that the women who were home with kids felt like the women who were working and in school didn't respect them because they weren't, quote, doing anything with their lives. And the women who were in school and working, when there were many of those, felt like the women who were home full-time didn't respect them because they were neglecting their families and off working. So, you know, it was like, oh, okay, let's all just relax here and do what the Lord is, where we feel drawn and where our mission lies, and maybe assume that maybe other people are not quite as judgmental about us as we seem to think they are because of our own feelings of where the adversary, I think, gets all to all of us, which is shame, you know, some kind of feeling of I'm not enough and I'm doing something I'm not supposed to that other people are not going to like. And let's just all, you know, get on the same page of let's do what we feel good about in our lives, what our mission is, recognizing that those missions are going to be very different for very different people and that that's okay. I'm thrilled to have in my own family right now a beautiful daughter-in-law raising 5 children and doing a fantastic job who is bright and capable and could do anything she wanted with her life. Mm-hmm. This is what she feels she's to be doing. And then a couple of daughters who have both gotten PhDs and are, one is working full-time plus, one is working part-time. They're all raising children. They're all trying to figure out what is the path that makes sense for me, given my skills, my interests, and the spiritual impressions that I have about where I belong and the values that I hold. So there is room for all of us, and we are all needed, and I have nothing but the greatest of respect for women who are navigating all of those different paradoxical problems and challenges in life.
And handling it like a boss, which is what I hear from your story, from those that I'm able to interview, from those I witness on a day-to-day, and it's inspiring. Men and women, I think it's important to recognize that sometimes within this that we get sort of focused on the women side of stuff, but that there are men who choose to be the stay at home or the in that role, and they are doing a phenomenal job and have made that choice.
And increasingly, that's something that I think people are paying attention to. I wanted to say to women for many years, you know, choose careers that allow you to be home with your kids. If you choose to do that, you know, as you're planning the education that you have, look for flexibility, for geographic flexibility, for time flexibility. But I'm increasingly saying that to men as well. If we're going to make this work for everybody, it really does help if you have some flexibility in what you're trying to do, so that you can play some in both spaces. And we're needed in both spaces. And yeah. Many cases. So
I absolutely love that. I think here is a natural place to take another break. And when we come back, we're going to spend the remainder of our time talking about how women can more fully exercise the holy authority in their daily service and work. It's the topic of your book. We'll talk all about it coming back in the third block of the Cultural Hall. Hey, everybody. Let's talk about Best DJ in Utah for just a minute. So here's the deal. Coronavirus has had an impact on said industry. Like, what do you mean, Richie? Well, literally every single event that I have for the month of March and the month of April, gone. Well, won't that impact your bottom line and your ability to live, Richie? Kind of. So when you're thinking about planning an event later in the year of 2020, won't you please consider bestdjinutah.com? It's simple. You can go there. You just fill out a little bit of information. Lets me know where the event is going to be. And then I provide a quote. I get it right back to you. And then maybe we can party together. Now, I do parties. You got the karaoke. We can do that too. Maybe you're making the pilgrimage to Utah and you want to have the big family reunion. I've done that. Maybe you're coming into town for one of those MLM conferences and you want to throw a big party for your team. I've done those as well. Doesn't matter what it is. Even if you just want to hang out with me, you can go to bestdjinutah.com, fill out the information, get a quote, and then maybe we can party together.
Imagine running a small business today. It's challenging. Imaging and internet presence is an absolute must. Even with that, you're still a small star in a bright cyber universe. Now, imagine you have someone who understands how to get your site designed for your talents and then easily searched by potential clients. Imagine Lennon Design. Whether it's strictly a website or a whole package of logo creation, advertising media, and promotional materials, Lennon Design is your partner in business. They'll test the boundaries of their imagination to create something unique for you. When you need creative, affordable design, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Here in the third block of the Cultural Hall, it's an important thing that we hear from you. If you like this episode, you can always send us an email, contact@theculturalhall.com, or reach out and follow us on any of the social medias that you may interact in. We're in all of them. You got the Pinterest and Twitter, and we've got Facebook and Instagram as well, present on all of them. It's at the Cultural Hall on all of them. And if you love this episode, we'd love for you to share it. If you have a suggestion for other episodes that you'd like to hear in the future, or particular points that Wendy has made in our discussion, we'd love to hear what you feel about this and or other episodes of the Cultural Hall. The name of your book is Live Up to Our Privileges, Women, Power, and Priesthood. Wendy Ulrich, answer the question. I'll give you the full slate of the remainder of our time. How can women more fully exercise the holy authority in their daily service and their work?
You know, it's really an interesting thing as I've worked on this book and talked to people about it, that I think women have really gotten the message from general authorities in the church in recent years that they have access to priesthood authority and priesthood power. That anyone who is operating under the influence, the direction of someone holding priesthood keys or someone that they delegate to has the access to priesthood authority, that in our callings, in our families, in the temple, we are absolutely acting with authority. And I think we kind of get that. And the question then becomes, what is this idea of power? I think it's interesting to reflect on what we mean by that. I think a lot of women are suspect of power, and for good reason. Power in this world is a dangerous commodity, and people use it in very inappropriate ways, and it gets associated with sort of command and control, with amassing resources to yourself and getting other people to do what you want. And that is not the kind of power, of course, that we're talking about in the gospel of Jesus Christ. In the gospel, power is about distributing the resources that you have. It's about making sure everyone has enough and to spare. It's about an assumption of abundance and not scarcity. It's about making sure that you invite and influence, not require and command and boss people around. It's about trying to help other people get what they want, not trying to get them to give you what you want. And I see those examples in the life of Jesus Christ and in our understanding of who God is and how he operates. So the kind of power that we're looking for is not something we need to be suspicious of. In fact, it's the kind of power that we came to this earth to acquire by our own experience. And that concept of experience is really important, I think. A lot of times women look at this issue of power in the priesthood and sort of feel like, okay, I get it. I've got authority. I've got power. There's something about priesthood that still applies to me as a woman. What is it? What am I supposed to be doing? You know, I'm supposed to be feeling powerful, and I'm supposed to be doing something different, and I'm supposed to be, I don't know, what is it? You know, and I think if I were to ask you as a man, what does it feel like to have power in the priesthood? You might be thinking about something different than what a lot of women are thinking about today. Matter of fact, I'll ask you that question, Richie. What do you think? If I were to say, when do you feel like you are exercising priesthood power? What does that look like in your life? What would you say?
Well, so honestly, I mean, it's the go-to answer probably, but truly in being able to serve other people. But immediately, What my mind went to is I had the rare opportunity the other night to give my wife a blessing, and there was something about being in that experience, or that she asked me to be some sort of conduit for an extra amount of faith or some sort of relay service for God. It was, as I say, rare. My wife's not a member of the church, so for her to have that belief was that it could be something that could help her was pretty special to me. But also that she would trust that I could deliver on that kind of thing. It was I say pride, and that's not the right word, but like it was a
confidence inspiring.
Yeah, a confidence inspiring. Yeah, thank you for putting words to what I couldn't. But confidence inspiring in myself to know, man, I can serve God in this special way.
Well, and that's one of the challenges that I faced as I started working on this topic, was that that is the most common way that both men and women think about power in the priesthood is in giving a blessing.
Yeah.
Feeling that experience of words coming into your mind and into your heart, impressions that come that you realize may or may not really come from you, that certainly come out of your love and concern for the person that you're trying to be a spokesperson for, you know, or to, but also recognizing that ideas and thoughts come from the Spirit. So if I'm a woman and that particular privilege is not one that I'm given with current policies in the church, have been in the past, but how do I exercise power? What does that really look like?
Right.
I think one of my hopes and purposes in this book was, as I said earlier, to both women and men, to try to expand our understanding of what priesthood power might entail and what it consists of, that it might be, we might need a larger definition of where it is used and what it feels like and how we develop it, and do we have a role in developing it? Is it just put your hands on somebody's head and wait for the Spirit to dictate what you say, or is there more involved? And I began to think about what I began to think about were all of the offices of the church, not just of the priesthood, not just the office of an elder, which is sort of the one that has been given claim right now on the gift or the privilege of laying hands on someone's head to give them a blessing, but in all of the offices of the priesthood, what are the ways that women and men can participate in the work of the Lord as it is sort of described by that office in the world for the salvation of the human family? And it was really fun for me to look at those different offices and think about, okay, if I'm giving the little talk to the 11-year-olds who are getting prepared to, you know, become to turn 11 next year, and they're going to be able to go do baptisms for the dead, and they're going to be deacons, and a primary president I love lately said, I don't even want to do that anymore, because now they're all together, and it's just in the face of the girls. The boys have this really cool thing, and you got nothing, you know. And I'm like, no, wait a minute. Let's look at that office of a deacon and say, okay, brethren, you have the duty and responsibility that comes with the order of the church of fulfilling this office to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to partake of the sacrament. Sisters, let's look at what you get to do by flexibility and opportunity to do the same thing. It may not be, well, you will pass the sacrament. I pass the sacrament every week. You know, it comes down my row, and I pass the sacrament. This is not some grand thing. I mean, I don't mean to undermine it, but it's just that the deacons have the responsibility, and this has not always been the case, but that's their current responsibility, to make sure everybody gets a sacrament. And I share in that responsibility. I help them with that responsibility. But I get the privilege of sitting there and being in a little more reverent, contemplative state because I'm not thinking about that duty. But I do have many opportunities in the church following the idea of what a deacon is, which is what you just said, a servant. Mm-hmm. The word deacon comes from the idea of waiting on tables. You know, that's what the word means, is literally a slave or a servant who takes care of the household and waits on tables and distributes the food and cooks it and all those kinds of things. And that doesn't seem like a very glorious thing in the lives of women, you know, if you're like me and don't really like to cook, until I realized this has been God's role in the human experience throughout the scriptures. You know, the first thing he does is provide food for Adam and Eve and tell them what they can eat, distributing manna in the wilderness, in feeding the 5,000. God and Jesus Christ and the apostles and disciples take the role of feeding the world. And what a privilege it is for us as men and women to think more broadly about how do we distribute the resources of the world and the resources of the church equitably among all people, which is what Zion will be, a place where there are no poor, where everyone has what they need. And are we engaged in that work today? The Lord says, blessed are those who are found feeding the hungry when I come again, who are found distributing the meat to everyone in due season. And so taking each of the offices of the priesthood and really examining what is the work of the Lord embodied in this office, how do I participate in it, whether I'm male or female, in a broader way, and how do I do that with spiritual power, which is, in as near as I can tell, the bottom line of that spiritual power is that I am doing it with the revelatory gifts of the Holy Ghost, that I have done the hard work of trying to understand how the Holy Ghost feels and thinks and works in my life, taking advantage of the privilege that I have been given to receive the gift of the Holy Ghost and the commandment I have been given to do that. How do I grow in that revelatory capacity? How do I increase my understanding of how that works? And my experience personally is, you know, as I mentioned early, is people can mess this up a lot. Mm-hmm. I have messed it up a lot. And we need to not be quite so afraid of messing it up that we just say, well, I can't tell if this is just my own head or if this is actually a thing of the Spirit. So I'm just going to play it safe and do nothing. We have to take the risk, and we have to say, okay, my best guess is this is just me, but let me try it and see what happens and see if I get any better at feeling my way to what's real here. Or let me check this out with somebody whose spirituality I trust. If I'm a little nervous about doing that, there may be a good chance I'm off base, you know. If I'm afraid to tell somebody else, well, you know, I'm thinking that I ought to move to Wyoming and dig a hole in the ground and live there, but I don't want to tell anybody that because they'll think I'm crazy. Well, maybe you do want to tell somebody that and check it out. Or if it's something that is, you know, I can see sort of a precedent. I mean, let's face it, Nephi did cut off the head of Laban.
Sure.
So maybe this thing that I'm thinking of that seems like it's against the commandments in every way is still a good idea. Well, maybe it's not. Let's look at the bigger picture of what the scriptures teach us and the covenants that we've made and see if we can get a little closer to what the Holy Ghost might be telling us. But sometimes we just have to be willing to say, I think this might be a spiritual impression. I don't know for sure, but yeah. I'm just going to act on it and see what happens if it's not just blatantly stupid, you know, or against the commandments, and see if I can grow in the principle of revelation. And I hear President Nelson all over that.
Yeah.
If we go back to the idea of, you know, what was Joseph Smith told? He was told that our generation, this generation of the period of the world that we're in, would hear God's word through the prophet, through him, and that the righteous and the humble and the pure in heart would seek counsel and authority and blessings under his hand. And his counsel in his, you know, in Brigham Young's experience with him was tell the people to get the Spirit, to be humble and faithful and keep the Spirit of the Lord, and it will lead us right. We have the authority to receive that gift, and we have the blessings that are offered to us as we do, which is power in the Spirit and power in the priesthood.
You know, it's interesting, though, as I think about this discussion that we have, the just amazing doctrine, for lack of a better word, that I feel like that you've shared, these insights that you find, that you have found and that you're able to share. The unfortunate thing is I think that there are some who, because it's not equal, just sort of dismiss a discussion that women could be able to feel, act, and have, you know, that power or the priesthood, or that once upon a time it was that way and is no longer, they get really wrapped up in that point and can't see all of these beautiful things that you've been discussing.
Well, and I get that, and I have been in those places. I totally understand that. One of my biggest fears about writing this book was I was just going to make everybody mad. You know, I was going to make the people mad who are like, if it's not equal and we don't have the priesthood, then why are you talking to me? And I was going to make the people mad who are saying, I got enough to do. I don't want anything more responsibilities in this stuff. I'm perfectly happy the way I am. Leave me alone. Mm-hmm. So, you know, finding some personal place that we can be comfortable with can be a long journey in that process. And as I say, I get it. I've struggled with both sides of that question. But I think the Lord is... I think he is in this, and I've taken great comfort in that quote from C.S. Lewis that mm-hmm. says, the things you least understand and you least like are sometimes the places where your greatest spiritual growth can be.
Yeah.
I have found that to be true sometimes, that it has been in struggling with what do I have that I have expanded my understanding of what the priesthood and priesthood power are about for everyone. And I think men have a lot to learn from women who are struggling with this issue and are sort of saying, wait a minute, there's more here than giving blessings, as well as we have a lot to learn from saying, wait a minute, how are there ways that I can pray more effectively with the same kind of revelatory power that it would have if I were giving a blessing? I've had that experience too, where just being asked to pray with somebody, I've realized, okay, this is time to, you know, pony up here. I mean... I'm just being asked to pray with someone I minister to. Do I bring the same sense of responsibility and authority and privilege to that prayer as I would laying my hands on somebody's head? Because we can. And the part of the scripture that talks about calling on the elders to give healing in the New Testament says, the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. We have the privilege of praying with the gifts of the Holy Ghost in ways that call down the powers of heaven. I think as much as through the laying on of hands in many cases, I think maybe some of those policies may again change in the future.
Yeah.
I don't know. I would hope that maybe they will. There is a time and a place where, you know, restrictions have been placed on a lot of things that are not necessarily about the worthiness or the righteousness of the people involved, but that serve a purpose in a particular period of time, or at least we hope they do. And the Lord, he is so creative at being redemptive in our lives of whatever the challenges are that we face or that we are subjected to turn them to good if we will just keep turning to him and saying, okay, given these limitations, show me what I can do.
Hmm.
And I think when we go there, the limitations begin to open up, not only immediately, but sometimes globally as well.
I think on the face of it, you hear the title of the book, Live Up to Our Privileges, Women, Power, and Priesthood, and people would assume, you know, maybe that it's a book written for women, right, that may be struggling with this idea of
sure.
power or priesthood. But what I love, 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 can't say love enough, but I'm not going to keep saying love because then we won't get to the end of this whole thing, is that it is a way for men to learn and respect and revere and all of those things in what we quite honestly probably just take for granted.
Yeah, I think there's learning for all of us here. I was thrilled, you know, I've heard that line, you're not living up to your privileges, we're not living up to our privileges, from Brigham Young to the priesthood, from Elder Uchtdorf to the priesthood, from Elder Packer to the priesthood. And it dawned on me one day that the first place I heard it was Joseph Smith talking to the Relief Society, saying, if you live up to your privileges, angels cannot be restrained from being your associates. Females can enter into the presence of God.
Mm.
Those are the blessings of the Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthood, the ministering of angels and entering into the presence of God that were being extended to all. And those blessings and that power is available to women and men as we expand our understanding by facing both the limitations and the gifts that we've been given with more creativity and more spirituality and more humility, and going to the Lord and saying, teach me, I want this power.
The book is called Live Up to Our Privileges, Women, Power, and Priesthood. Wendy Ulrich is the author, and you can find that wherever you get books, but particularly, why not go to DeseretBook.com? They're good friends here of the Cultural Hall. Pick it up and you can be able to enjoy that. They've got it both in the online reader versions, or you can even within the quarantine and coronavirus be able to drive up and get a copy of that book. They'll bring it curbside to you. You have written a plethora of books. What's the next project you're working on?
Not really sure. Still kind of giving that some thought. I'm hoping during the quarantine here, maybe I'll find us some direction on that. I'm thinking about writing some more on how do we develop the skills of spiritual power, because I think there are skills, not just gifts, involved.
I love it. We ask everyone who steps into the Cultural Hall three questions. I'll ask those of you now. The first question is, do you have a calling right now? And if so, what is it?
I am an institute teacher in a YSA stake in BYU, which means right now I kind of don't have a calling. Currently, BYU is suspended.
But yeah. You get a vacation. That's what you get. That's your calling.
Yeah.
And with all the work that you've done, you deserve it. So I'd say take advantage of that time.
I plan to.
If you could pick a calling for yourself, either one that exists or make one up, what would you pick?
That's a fun question. I love teaching the gospel, and am grateful that in the 15 years we've lived in Utah, that has been my permanent calling, has been teaching the gospel in some capacity or another. I did a short stint as a counselor in a Relief Society presidency, and I told the bishop when he extended the calling, I'll do this if you won't take away my teaching calling. And he said, well, that was what I was hoping you'd say. So I'm happy teaching the gospel in any capacity at any time.
The last question that we ask, and you may interpret this however you would like, but the question remains, what is your favorite part of your faith?
My favorite part of my faith is the amazing doctrinal perspective of the purpose of life and eternity that we get from this faith. The thing that we get scoffed at, I think, the most is our understanding of the nature of God, not just the nature of God as in Joseph Smith's understanding that they were two personages with bodies, but the nature of God from his understanding that they are people of compassion who know us by name and want to save us and help us find relief from our feelings of inadequacy and not being enough that come with the human condition and the weakness that we're in. But the amazing thing that I think we understand in the gospel is, this is who God is. He is one who empowers his children with the power that he has. And this is who he's trying to help us become, are people who empower others with the power of God that we are trying to learn in our own lives. So helping the next generation to do that is a remarkable opportunity and a perspective on the purpose of life.
We hope that this episode has nourished and strengthened your body, that if you're not healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week, and that when the time comes, you'll be able to travel home in safety. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat, it's sure to be